Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Platz coming at you live, and it's our weekly book club class here for Gulf Manor Synagogue, our School of Jewish Studies, through sheerenjoyment.com. Thank you, Mitch and Jake, for all you do for our classes here at the School of Jewish Studies of Gulf Manor Synagogue. On Monday afternoons, we always meet for book club, and we are currently very much in the thick of reading, studying the book known as The Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy, recently published by the OU, a series of lectures by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University, who became the president of the American Mizrahi in the 40s, I believe, and so he is offering speeches that the book is chock full of speeches that he gave as president of the Mizrahi. Today, it's going to be a start of a new talk, and it's called, "And a Man Wrestled with Him Until the Break of Dawn." And that was delivered in May of 1946. Curious how the words, "and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn," are pointed. The word "him" is capitalized with a capital H. That can only mean that it's referencing God, so that you would read it, "and a man wrestled with God until the break of dawn." Whereas I was always taught that Jacob, the man, in this verse is wrestling with an angel. And most rabbis feel it's the angel of Esav. And so he vanquishes Esav in this fight, in this physical fight. To say that he's wrestling with the Almighty is a whole different take. I cannot wait to see what he does with it. But clearly, there's a reason why they're capitalizing the letter H. Delivered after the war, Second World War was concluded. Of course, that was in August of 1945. So within the year after that, he gives this speech before the American Mizrahi. "And a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn." May 1946. Hebrew, which has a rich reservoir of synonyms, has very many words for the verb to see. Lirot, lahabit, or lirot means to see. Lahabit means maybe to cast a look. Lahashkif, to have an outlook, to look out on. Letzafot, maybe to look expectantly towards. I'm coming up with definitions of these verbs. Listakel, to look upon maybe oneself. And lachazot, to envision, to have a vision of something. I got to confess, I personally never really even thought about this, that Hebrew has a rich reservoir of verbs for praising God. But even for the verb to see, there's a whole bunch. I just gave you six, and each one is nuanced and a little bit different than the other one. Back to Soloveitchik. Here is not the place to undertake a proper analysis of the subtle differences between the various terms. The main thing that I wish to emphasize at this juncture is that there is a real philosophical hierarchy ascending from the lowest level, lirot, to see, to the highest, lachazot, to have a vision. Lirot, to see in its simple, mundane sense, denotes physiological, psychological perception. The sense of sight is not a gift bestowed by the Almighty exclusively upon man, but rather upon the natural world at large. And in many cases, an animal's senses are far more perfect than our man's. However, physiological, psychological perception is limited to the surfaces of objects, which reflect light onto the eye's retina. It cannot penetrate into the depths of those objects and view their inner structure. It is also limited by distance and time. One can only see an object at a certain remove and in the present. In addition, the ancient Greeks already knew that the eye is often the victim of optical illusions, some of them due to physical, others to physiological, psychological causes. The Fata Morgana, seen by the desert wanderer, I looked that up on the web. It's a mirage. I think also out at sea. And also apparently in the desert, the person looks up and he sees something. It's not really there. But I guess he sure wants it to be there. And so he has this optical illusion. And it's called like the Fata Morgana, like Morgan the fairy or something. An Italian term, Fata Morgana. I had never heard of it until I saw that you mentioned it. The Fata Morgana seen by the desert wanderer, as well as the modern cinematic film, illustrate best how the human eye can be fooled. I mean, after all, how right is he? And he was saying this in 1946. Imagine going into a theater now, and you see science fiction stuff, action films. You see superhero movies. I mean, the special effects are absolutely incredible. And if you were to swear, you'd say, yeah, that's exactly what happened. I mean, Iron Man just, you know, went up to the heavens and he dropped off an atomic bomb and it blew up, you know, Loki's whole thing up in the other dimension. And you're starting to explain what you just saw. And meanwhile, what you just saw, lo hayeva lo nivra ba'emes. I mean, it never could have happened. That has never happened. It won't happen. There's no flying spaceship all the way up there that Loki is in charge of, and Iron Man doesn't exist, and there's no atomic missile going up there and blowing it up. The whole thing doesn't exist. And yet you saw it in The Avengers, number one, right? The first film, right? Didn't you see it there? I saw it. Didn't happen. It's all a movie. And so the Fata Morgana seen by the desert wanderer, as well as the modern cinematic film, illustrate best how the human eye can be fooled. Lachazot, to envision, the goal of lerot, to see. And the most elevated form of sight, when it transforms into vision, is not a simple, natural, physiological, psychological phenomenon. It's a spiritual act. Only a human being, and moreover, a great personality, blessed with vision and prophetic intuition, can be a chose, a seer. S-E-E-R, somebody who has the ability to see into the reality of things, to see deeply into something, to see the future, to know the past, to understand the present, to see the future, to see critically into something and understand it. Only a great personality blessed with vision and prophetic intuition can be a chose, like the chose of Lublin, who Moshe Kabach likes to say, was able to see from one end of the world to the other, or words to that effect. He was gifted by God with this great ability to see deeply. What? Right, from the deepest depths. Exactly, Sarah says. To perceive not only the surface, but also the substance of a thing, to break through the outer shell and penetrate into the core of a phenomenon, to view its inner structure and essence, one must be half a prophet and possess the spark of Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit. The Choyze, the seer, is able not only to perceive the intimate content of an object, but also to see it in context, connected with the endless process of events unfolding in the past and in the unending future. For him, the present is only a single point along the great eternal timeline of Min Ha'olam V'ad Ha'olam. From eternity to eternity, the Choyze, the seer, views the whole, the totality of creation. Anyone who has even a passing familiarity with the history of the natural sciences. Now, this is where, Father, let me break in. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik is unique among Torah scholars, because not a single one of them today, and I mean not a single one, talks in any of these terms. I mean, this is unique to him. Happens to be, he had a PhD in philosophy from Berlin, and so along the way to getting a PhD in philosophy, he studied math, chemistry, biology, and physics. You don't just get a PhD in philosophy without taking some other courses as well, apparently. And even if he didn't take those formal courses, he certainly read enough about them to be able to speak about them. And he's going to do that. He speaks about history, speaks about physiological, psychological approaches to history. No Torah scholar today talks in these terms. Now, he's speaking in Yiddish. Remember, in 1946, he's speaking to a bunch of Yiddish-speaking, Yiddish-understanding Mizrachists in America. In 1946, he's still speaking in Yiddish. He's still giving a shiur in Yiddish at Yeshiva University. He had not yet, I think, flipped over to English. That, I think, came in the 1950s, when he saw that the Bachurim didn't know much Yiddish anymore. So he began speaking in English, and that was like the king's English. He was an unusual person in every way, this man. I mean, he came over from Europe, Torah scholar, Yiddish speaker, and came right and knew German because he went to Berlin, And then he came in and mastered English, and he started giving shiurim in English and speaking in English, writing in English, an amazing person everywhere. And so his knowledge base about science and history is unique among Torah scholars because, frankly, I got to confess, and I don't mean to impugn anybody, but today's Torah scholars don't know anything about science, and their knowledge of history is not the greatest. And yet here's a man who's super knowledgeable about all these things, and he puts together these beautiful thoughts, and he packages them in such thought. Where do you hear this? It's just beautiful. Anyone who has even a passing familiarity with the history of the natural sciences knows quite well that as long as man relied on his naive, naked eye and on a superficial perception of objects, he remained lost in the labyrinth of the universe and could not discover the cosmic coherence within nature. Who talks like that? All of modern physics, listen to this. This is a Torah scholar per excellence. All of modern physics constitutes a critique of this naive mode of worldly observation and an affirmation of the power of vision supported by experimentation. Physics is a critique of a naive looking at the world. It's a much more sophisticated one. Obviously, it's supported by everything from calculus to telescopes, none of which they have in ancient times. And it affirms the power of chazon, of vision, supported by experiments, which they weren't doing back in the day. Continues Rabbi Soloveitchik, if this is the case in the physical world, in the realm of matter and energy, then it is all the more so in the spiritual world, in the realm of history and human creative freedom. Superficial perception of historical events, naive reaction to historical catastrophes and cataclysms, to the zigzag of good and evil, of angel and Satan, is simply fatal and thoroughly wrong. In order to understand history, a person must be a visionary, a choseh, a seer, and must possess the kind of spiritual eye of which the great medieval Jewish and Christian philosophers spoke so much. Another remarkable thing for a Torah scholar to say, to even acknowledge the existence of Christians is generally taboo. But to acknowledge them positively and link them together in one sentence, to possess as a choseh does, quote, the kind of spiritual eye of which the great medieval Jewish and Christian philosophers spoke so much, that's revelatory. That means he actually read the Christian philosophers, and he equates them positively with Jewish philosophers. A remarkable thing. As the great historian once put it, and here's quoting George Santayana, if one does not grasp the historical forces and trends of past centuries, then one is doomed to fall victim to history. God gave man, both in his role as a natural creature, in contact with the biological and physical universe, and in his role as a spiritual persona, operating in a particular historical context, God gave man a choice, either to understand nature and history, and thus control them, or to be mistaken about and fall victim to them. Both the natural world and the historical world can be rather gentle and benign if one can conquer them through knowledge and understanding. Such a victory earns man the love and respect of both inanimate nature and the living forces of history. By the same token, if man loses the battle because of ignorance and weakness, then nature and history begin to persecute him. Top of page 83. In the gigantic clash between man and the universe, the former, man, can only gain respect by ruthlessly defeating and subjugating the latter, the universe. Genesis chapter 1, God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it, and rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the living things that creep on earth. This is man's God-given task and duty. And is not modern science, in part, the victory of man's intellectual perception and vision over nature? That's why nature has become friendlier toward modern men, but had been so cruel toward primitive man who had lost the battle. And if, Morai v'Rabotai, historical vision is necessary for all men, it's 1,000 times more important and essential for us Jews. Jewish history today must be viewed from the perspective of chazon, vision, prophecy. We dare not isolate the present, observing it positivistically using the physiological, psychological sense of sight. For on the surface, our present reality is far too absurd, irrational, wild, chaotic. And it may in fact remain that way, becoming an abyss into which we only continue to fall without ever being able to erect a logical, historical structure and to discern a purposeful development of law and causality. One cannot attain historical vision via naive observation of the present, isolated from the past and the future, but must rather do so via consideration of Jewish historical fate in its totality. Deuteronomy 32, Moses says, "Remember the days of old. Consider the years of ages past. Ask your father. He will inform you. Your elders, they will tell you." In the wilderness, the Jews, in fact, committed two cardinal sins. One, the sin of the golden calf. And two, the sin of the spies. When we read the story of the calf, our blood boils in response to such baseness. A faith discovered, cultivated by Abraham over the course of centuries of profound understanding of nature and prophetic comprehension of the cosmic process, revealing that hidden behind everything is an invisible God and creator of the world. A faith confirmed by extraordinary wonders in Egypt, at the Red Sea, and on Mount Sinai, where the entire terrestrial drama was vanquished and a supernatural world order was revealed, was suddenly abandoned and exchanged for a golden calf. One cannot psychologically comprehend the mentality of those 600,000 Jews. Even the most primitive human beings, it seems to me, would not have behaved that way, fabricating a golden calf and prostrating themselves before it. Top page 84. By contrast, the sin of the spies was, it appears at first glance, no crime whatsoever. Moses had dispatched scouts on God's orders and directed them, to spy out the land, giving them specific instructions about what to look for, what to report on. Quote, Numbers 13, Moses says, "See what kind of country it is. Are the people who dwell in it strong or weak? Few or many? Are the towns that live in open or fortified? Is the soil rich or poor? Is it wooded or not?" The scouts set out and traversed the land, bringing back to Moses a precise, exhaustive account without a single exaggerated or unnecessary word. In fact, a model espionage report. "We came to the land you sent us to. It does indeed flow with milk and honey. However, the people who inhabit the country are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the Anakites there. It would seem they did nothing that could be conceived of as a violation of their mission. And yet the master of the universe forgave the sin of the golden calf almost completely. And to this very day, we still celebrate Yom Kippur as the day of pardon, absolution, and mercy. Whereas on account of the sin of the spies, the Jews wandered in the wilderness for 40 years until that entire generation died out. God took an oath that no one, aside from Joshua and Caleb, would merit to enter the land of Israel. As I live, says the Almighty, I will do to you just as you have urged me." See Numbers 14. Why is that? The answer is simple. The mistake of the golden calf was rooted in an incorrect interpretation of nature, in a naive understanding of the blind forces of the cosmos. The sin of the spies, by contrast, was the result of a naive interpretation of history, of being confounded by the Anakites, the Nephilim, and the great fortresses, of a superficial understanding of Jewish history and Jewish fate. The men of the golden calf story observed nature as it is, rather than as visionaries, while the generation of the spies viewed Jewish historical fate superficially as ro'im, those who see with a superficial look, rather than as chozim, those who see it with a supernatural depth. That's why the second sin was greater than the first. One cannot enter the land of Israel with an incorrect interpretation of history. After all, this is me jumping in. If I can amplify Rabbi Soloveitchik, when you've got spies and they're sent by Moses, and you have already seen the plagues in Egypt, and you saw the splitting of the sea, and you saw the dead Egyptians, and you got all their gold, and then you got ready for Matan Torah, and you got the Torah, and all the thunder and lightning, and you live through that, and then you live through the golden calf, and God ultimately forgives, and now you're this close to entering the land of Israel, and you forget whatever you just saw. Where's Jewish history up until now? It's pretty new. I mean, the Jewish nation, the Israelite nation, is pretty new. Newborn, if you will, at Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and then perhaps again at and fully converted everybody at Matan Torah. So it's a very new nation. And yet you've seen stuff. You saw the plagues. You were in Egypt and you saw what was going on. Remarkable things being brought upon your enemy, and you guys are sailing through. And then you walk out heads held high. And then 7 days later, you're about to get killed by the incoming Egyptian army. But God drowns them all, and you are all saved. And you all get enriched. And then you get the Torah. And then, of course, the golden calf. But still, you should be saying to yourself, there is a God in heaven. He's on our side. He wants us to go into the land. We should go into the land. Let's get some faith over here. And they didn't have it. They viewed Jewish history from only that moment, only those 40 days or so, whatever they took to spy out the land. They came back with a very jaundiced look at the land without realizing we've been living through godly miracles. This is going to be just another one of the many miracles. So let's go in there and do it. No, no, no. The Nephilim, the Anakites, the fortress walls, it's going to be too much for us. They did not incorporate Jewish history and a Jewish vision into their report. One cannot enter the land of Israel with an incorrect interpretation of history. In order to comprehend Jewish history and grasp its coherence and trends, its structure and sense, we must not forget one rule, which is the guiding principle of every visionary and prophet. We dare not deny, falsify, or embellish reality. I already stated once at a Mizrahi gathering, previous lecture that we saw already, that the vision of a prophet consists of two parts, hakarat ha'oveh, an appreciation of the present, in all of its terrifying monstrosity, and Chazon Ha'atid, a vision for the future, in all of its splendor and full magnificence. If you've been listening to these lectures, you know that he spoke about, last time he spoke, previous lecture was at the very end of World War II, or certainly the end of the European theater. And it was just a matter of time before the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan, ending the Pacific theater. And so he was talking about how, as Jewish people, we have to get right with reality. We have to acknowledge what happened to us. Cannot deny it. We just suffered an incredible, catastrophic loss, an atrocity of epic proportions, on par with anything that the Korban by Rishon and Sheni gave us. And numbers, sheer numbers, much more than the Crusades, and much more than Khmelnytsky massacres. I mean, who can imagine 6 million people? Can't even imagine 1 million. 6 million, but it simply boggles the mind. And so, Hakarat Ha'oveh, he said, an appreciation and understanding of the present tense in all its terrifying monstrosity, he says over here, is a necessity. You have to understand we've lost so many people with so much potential, so much creativity, so much knowledge, so much holiness, all lost. And Chazon Ha'atid must have a future, a vision of the future, of the future glory that's going to happen for Klal Yisrael. That's got to be the lodestar. You got to be looking at that. So we can't forget the present, and we must always be looking to the future. Top page 85. There's a remarkable passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, Sukkah chapter 5, Halacha 1, that is cited by the Tosfos in Sukkah. Quote, Jonah ben Amittai was one of the festival pilgrims. He attended the celebration at the place of water drawing, talking about the famous ritual that the Jewish people did of Simchas Beis HaShoeva, where they would draw water from the springs and carry it, pour it, the whole beautiful ritual. Rabbis say famously that anybody who saw that saw joy, and anybody who did not merit to see such a wonderful ritual never saw anything joyous in his life. So Yonah ben Amittai, famous Jonah of the eponymously named Jonah of the Hebrew Bible, Jonah ben Amittai was one of the festival pilgrims. He attended the celebration at the place of water drawing, and Ruach HaKodesh descended upon him, end quote. The question is, how does the Jerusalem Talmud know that this story happened to Jonah specifically and not to other prophets? And anyway, why are our sages so interested in knowing how Jonah became a prophet? Now listen to this beautiful interpretation. This is really absolutely, he's going to draw a distinction between Jonah on the one hand and Moses and Yirmiyahu on the other hand. Moshe and Yirmiyahu had their lives and Jonah had his experience and they're not all the same. I'm going to call it Moses Jeremiah, Moshe Jeremiah on one hand. Watch what he writes. The answer is, again, how does the Jerusalem Talmud know that this happened to Jonah specifically, and why are our sages so interested in knowing how he became a prophet? The answer is that the Jerusalem Talmud is depicting Jonah in contrast with the other prophets. Jonah's story is astonishing in that he suppressed his prophecy. He ran away from God, hid, and resisted fulfilling his mission. Moses and Jeremiah also did not wish to prophesy. The master of the universe had to persuade and, as if one could say this, beg them. Chazal tell us that the Shekhinah, the Holy Spirit, implored Moses for 7 days to undertake to become the Redeemer. See Shmos Rabbah chapter 3. But that was only at first. Now watch this. From the moment Moshe and Yirmiyahu finally accepted their task and promised to go, nothing in the world could stop them. Not Pharaoh, the taskmasters, or the mixed multitude, not the golden calf, spies, or false prophets, not the insults, persecutions, or disappointments, and not the derision of the masses. Isaiah 50, I offered my back to the floggers and my cheeks to those who tore out my hair. Enormous patience, endurance, resoluteness, and unshakable faith led them along their prophetic path, which was not always strewn with roses. Neither Moshe nor Yirmiyahu ever suppressed his prophecy, climbed onto a foreign ship, and escaped to Tarshish. Neither ever deserted God and Israel. They died as faithful guardians of their people. By contrast, with respect to Jonah, it is nowhere reported that he had to be begged or that he argued with the Almighty about his task. The word of God came to Jonah, son of Amittai, Jonah chapter 1. And Jonah gladly accepted his mission. And yet a little while later, he regretted doing so and escaped to the Mediterranean Sea via ship. What a strange paradox. Top of 86. Our sages therefore explain that the reason for this can be traced to the prehistory of Moshe and Yirmiyahu's prophecy on the one hand, and of Jonah's on the other. Moses and Jeremiah's theophanies and prophetic visions did not come upon them by accident, without preparation, without profound, comprehensive understanding and appreciation of the enormous tragedy of the present in all its ugliness. Ruach HaKodesh did not descend upon them all of a sudden, but rather after a long journey of suffering and hardship, after integrating themselves into the Jewish people. Moshe had to, quote, witness their labors. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. He found two Hebrews fighting, but shepherds came and drove them off, end quote. See Exodus chapter 2. All the world's brutality and cynicism revealed themselves before him. Only then did he receive the great prophetic, all-embracing vision of a bush all aflame, tahasineh enenu ukar, yet the bush was not consumed. The same was true for Jeremiah. He experienced the dissolution of Jewish sovereignty. He felt the tragedy of Judea. He understood the Jews' needs, torments, and hopes. Only then did he begin to see God. At first, they both equivocated, fearing that their human powers were insufficient to carry out a superhuman task, to become a redeemer from Egypt or a prophet of destruction. But as soon as God convinced them that they would realize their dreams, they set out and devoted themselves to the Knesset Yisrael, the Assembly of Israel. Jonah's prophecy, by contrast, came about by accident. On the intermediate days of the festival of Sukkot, he entered the temple courtyard, where a great Jewish congregation was ecstatically singing, "We are to God, and our eyes are to God." See Sukkot chapter 5, Mishnah 4, and juggling flaming torches. He identified with the ecstatic masses who sang, danced, and ascended to the level of Ruach HaKodesh. In the heat of the moment, Jonah psychologically fused together with the enthusiastic congregation of pietists and men of action. And without any effort on his part, he received a prophetic vision. Missing, though, were the sleepless nights and anxious mornings of a Moses or a Jeremiah, the doubts and sorrows of a Redeemer. The prophecy, the Chazon Ha'atid, the deep future vision, without the accompanying Hakarat Ha'ove, acknowledgement of the painful present, came upon him too quickly. As long as he found himself in a warm religious setting, filled with ecstatic excitement and apocalyptic faith, as well as joy, enthusiasm, and Ruach HaKodesh, he believed in his task and in the possibility of carrying it out. The moment he stepped out onto the cold, scornful street, he lost his enthusiasm and his faith in his abilities. The fire was extinguished, and he panicked and ran away. Before we paint a visionary picture of the future of the Jewish people, we must have a clear picture of the present. However, by picture of the present, I do not simply mean newspaper reports, but rather a deeper understanding. We must derive from current events a pair of historical principles or laws that are operative in our faithful existence and formulate them clearly. I do not seek here to provide any cures for anti-Semitism, because I do not know what can heal that illness. I seek only to trace in clear terms the historical profile of our fate. Whether it is good or bad is entirely immaterial, since history does not ask us how it should play itself out. Principle A, the Jewish question and anti-Semitism are not bound up exclusively with political structures like fascism and democracy, on the one hand, or economic systems like capitalism and socialism, on the other. Certainly, it was a fascist power that became the Jewish people's Amalek. But in essence, German bestial anti-Semitism was nourished less by fascist political theories than by the specific psychology and particular structure of the German mentality. Italy, despite its fascist regime, was not anti-Semitic, so long as it was not allied with Hitler. The danger is obviously far greater when the government is fascist, because then every demagogue and murderer can exploit the anti-Semitic predilections of his nation for his own purposes and massacre millions of people. However, I can well imagine a democratic Germany with a Treblinka and Majdanek in the background. The entire nation knew what was going on. Russia is no democracy, and yet it is also not anti-Semitic. By contrast, the liberated countries of Europe, like Czechoslovakia, Poland, France, and Holland, are, despite their democratic institutions, poisoned with anti-Semitism. You could argue that wherever there is anti-Semitism, there is ipso facto no democracy. Granted. But I believe that what gets called democracy in the language of political philosophy is still no guarantee of philo-Semitism. Likewise, neither capitalism nor socialism secures the fate of the Jews. At its core, Nazism was not a capitalistic movement. The Labour government in England does not treat us any better than do the capitalists, the conservatives. And in certain ways, it treats us even worse. I wish to stress that my words should not be interpreted as asserting that we, Jews, are uninterested in political governmental structures and social justice issues like labor rights. Heaven forbid. Our entire Torah is founded upon the demand for justice for the weak and oppressed and equality for all. We fight alongside everyone else for social ideals. However, again, the Jewish question will not be solved through social or political changes. Rabbi Ishmael said, the five fingers of the Blessed Holy One all hint at redemption. The Blessed Holy One used the pinky to demonstrate how to build the ark. As it says, this is how you shall make it. Genesis 6. He used the ring finger to smite the Egyptians. As it says, Etzpa Lakimhu. This is the finger of God. The finger used to redeem the world by bringing a deluge and eradicating evil, plunder, and brutality is not the same finger as the one used to redeem Israel by fighting Pharaoh. Pharaoh was persecuting Jews after the deluge, after the wicked had been annihilated and drowned in the flood of their own crimes. And the master of the universe has a special finger on his hand for dealing with the Jewish question. Jews must know and remember this because they very often forget it. The socialist youth at the time of the Russian Revolution forgot it. The Western European assimilationists failed to understand it, and even many of our ilk do not grasp it, as when they buttress their support for the return to Zion on humanitarian grounds. I wish to emphasize again that I am not one of the Sholalei Hagalut, the diaspora negators, or the alarmists who yell that Jews living in the diaspora are finished and their situation is hopeless. Such declarations are silly, even when they emanate from the land of Israel. However, I want Jews to remember that their problems will not be solved by the Atlantic Charter, even if the whole document were to be put into practice, all the more so given that the entire dream has come to nothing. The struggle for the fair treatment of Jews is still far from won, even in the freest democracies and despite the best intentions of their governments. If the Jewish question is not simply a problem of the weak and helpless, but has a specifically Jewish overtone, then we must come to an appreciation of what is different and distinctive about our history and find a way to formulate it. I believe that the entire complex exists more on the metaphysical plane than on the economic political plane. Okay, over here we've just concluded Principle A about the Jewish question and anti-Semitism, how it's going to be solved not on the economic political plane, but rather on a metaphysical plane. So I recommend we end over here. I know it's a little bit early, but let's end over here. We've concluded up to page 88. We'll start afresh on page 89, God willing, next week, when we'll see Principle B. And it'll all be about a man wrestled with Jacob until the break of dawn. So we'll be getting to the actual title of this lecture, and a man wrestled with him until dawn. He'll be discussing that, God willing, next week. So please come on back next week, and we'll pick it up then on page 89 as we march toward the conclusion of it, which is on page 109. So we have 20 pages to go. Maybe we can actually do it next week and conclude it. Hopefully that'll be the case. Wishing everybody a great rest of the day. Zeit gesund. Have a healthy day, successful day, and God willing, see you tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we continue our study of 2 Kings chapter 20, Hezekiah, his illness, his prayer, and his recuperation and the healing of Hezekiah by God. Super interesting stuff. Join me and everybody at 7:30 tomorrow night. Wishing a big thank you to Jake and Mitch at sheerenjoyment.com for publishing these wonderful classes. Thank you very much, everybody, on behalf of Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Shmuel Plotzker signing off. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow night at 7:30. Take care. Be well. Bye-bye now.